Thank you, Father Peter. It's very, very nice for me to be here today. This is really very, very much a homecoming for me. While I've been in Southern California for almost 10 years now, the first 40, 42 years of my life were spent here in the Bay Area. And looking out at a lot of very familiar faces, it's very, very nice to be here. It's kind of like a homecoming for me. So I'm very pleased to be here. I was asked to come here today to tell you the story of my conversion to Orthodoxy. And it's indeed a pretty remarkable journey. And it's certainly a testament to the patience and the love of God and his tremendous intercessions in searching out and recovering one of his lost sheep. To be quite honest, I've really struggled over the past month or so since Father Peter asked me to come share this talk with what seemed, at least up to this point, a rather personal story. And as I've thought about this and as I've prayed about it and as I've sought the counsel of other people, it's occurred to me that this is precisely not my story. This is not and should not be about me. It's about Christ and about his tremendous patience and his intercessions, as I said, in searching out one of his lost sheep. As Father Peter mentioned, I serve the parish there in Hollywood. So let me put it this way. Christ is and must be the star of this story. And I, in my best and brightest moments, have been nothing more than a supporting actor. And I think, as you'll see, in many cases, I've either been an antagonist or maybe a not-so-innocent bystander to the workings of God in my life. So with the blessings of Ladika and with your prayers and patience, I'll begin. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. So I was born and raised right across the bridge in Oakland and in San Leandro. And my family consisted of my father, my mother, my older brother, and myself. I was baptized as an infant in the Episcopalian Church, and I have fond memories of those early years of my childhood in the Episcopal Church, the procession of the priests and the altar servers up the center aisle, going up to the altar rail and receiving the communion wafer, and getting the basics of the gospel story through our Sunday school Bible classes. I pretty much took all of this in without a lot of question or resistance, and I would say that throughout my childhood I had kind of a low flame on the back burner, a basic understanding and acceptance of God. While my mother and my father were extremely good, hardworking, very moral people, you definitely couldn't call them religious. And by the time I was 8 or 9 years old, the preoccupations of boyhood started to take precedence, and we pretty much fell out of going to church on any kind of regular basis. My great preoccupations at that time were twofold. One was baseball, and the other was the Beatles. If you'd asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up at that time, I think I was pretty certain that I was either going to be a Hall of Fame second baseman, or if that didn't work out, I could always fall back on being a rock star. All of that kind of normal 1960s American childhood came crashing to a halt during my 12th year. It was during that year that my mother was diagnosed with cancer. She had been a smoker all of her life, as was the fashion, and she ended up contracting lung and throat cancer. And over the course of that year, my seventh grade year, she died a rather slow and painful death. I remember being quite conflicted. On the one hand, I was my heart was breaking as I listened to her struggling for breath at night and, you know, coughing incessantly. But there was also a part of me that was just tremendously irritated with the noise. And it was a very confusing and kind of torturous time for me. But it was also at this time that I started to turn again to God. I remember riding my bicycle up into the hills above our town and begging God to heal my mother. And as the disease progressed and as the inevitable became pretty clear, I remember riding up into the hills and begging that God would take her away. And indeed, not too long after that, she did indeed die. My mother and I were kind of an alliance within the family unit. My older brother and my father were kind of a pair, and my mother and I were kind of a pair. So with the loss of my mother, I was really kind of set adrift. I didn't know what to make of things. I had a lot of resentment and anger. And this was right at the end of my elementary school time, entering into junior high school. And this was 1973. If you put those two things together, you might imagine where I turned to at this time. I ended up getting into the hell of drugs. And for the next year and a half, I fell into this world. And I would say that my foray into that drug abuse was fueled by a couple of things. One was, I think, just a desire to be a cool guy. But also there was an attempt to kind of anesthetize the pain that I was going through. And also there was a bit of a desire to break through to the other side, as the Doors put it. I had to find out what was beyond this this everyday world, this normal consciousness. And where did my mother go? You know, what was life? What was death? What was the meaning of all this suffering? And part of my experimentation with drugs certainly had something to do with that. So I lived in that world, or was dying in that world, I should say, for about a year and a half, until the precise date of January 9th, 1975. And on that day, something happened to me that completely and unalterably changed my life forever. I was at home, and my brother and my father were in an argument of some kind. It was, he'd got a bad grade, or it was something rather trivial, but their raised voices were being amplified in my mind. And so I went upstairs to my room to try to get away from this noise. I could still hear it. I closed the door. I could still hear it. I covered my ears. I could still hear it. Everything was kind of building up into this crescendo for me. And in a moment of tremendous stupidity, I looked over at my window, and I thought, I'm going to run and jump out. I probably would have done nothing more than broke an ankle. This was only second floor, but I was stupid, what can I say? So I ran toward the window, and I hit up against it. And at that moment, I looked up into the sky, and I saw something. I saw something that just shook me to the core of my being. I looked up into the sky and I saw an image of the face of Christ. It shook me, and I fell back into the room. And the next 2 hours, are the details of that are completely unknown to me. I don't remember anything that was said or what I said, but suddenly 2 hours just went by like that. What I do remember is a tremendous, tremendous sense of stillness, of incredible reverence towards something very, very holy, and overwhelming love. The other thing that I remember and I take from that time is it's almost like God placed a compass into my soul that was geared toward this magnetic north that God wanted me to head toward. And that compass point was certainly pointed toward Christ, and helped guide me over the course of the next several years that I'll be going into here. So suddenly, it's 2 hours later, and I'd been expecting a friend that evening, and this friend showed up, and he took one look at me, and he said, "You look like you've seen a ghost." And my response was, "I think I have." He was what we called at that time, and forgive the term, a Jesus freak, kind of a hippie for Jesus. And he ended up spending the whole night with me, and we talked and talked and talked, and he ended up showing me various verses from the Gospels, and by the time that night was over, I had prayed the appropriate prayers, accepting Christ into my heart, and by dawn of the next morning, I was saved. At least I thought so. Over the course of the next several years, pretty much my high school career, I became a Jesus freak myself, and I wore the Jesus t-shirts, and I wore this big wooden cross on the outside of my clothes. It was almost as big as this one. Went to Christian rock concerts. I read the Bible cover to cover and had a very active prayer life. And in a sense, it did save me. It certainly saved me from the destructive path that I was on. And there was a lot of good that came out of it. I certainly got a foundation there that kind of carried me forward. But the sheer enthusiasm of all that started to wane by the time I was completing my high school time. And it started to be clear to me that the Christ that I'd experienced that January afternoon was a bit of a far cry from the Christ that I was experiencing with my Jesus freak friends. While there was great enthusiasm and joy, and this was all very, very good for me, there was something missing. There was missing that sense of reverence, that sense of holiness, that sense of something other, that that Christ wasn't my buddy. He was my God. And so as I finished high school and made my way into the community college, I think I was ripe for my next encounter. It was at that time that I met a guy who was about 7 or 8 years older than I, a fellow named Jeff, and Jeff was a Buddhist. And I started talking to Jeff and became good friends with him, and he started sharing with me various Buddhist texts and taught me meditation. And there was something very, very attractive to me about all of this. I found in Buddhism more of this sense of reverence and of stillness that was really sorely lacking in the experience of Christianity that I'd had up to that point. And somehow the Buddhism that I was encountering was tipping that needle a little closer to where I felt I needed to go. So during those 2 years of community college, I dove into Buddhism, and from Buddhism I started reading Ram Dass and Yogananda and others, and started getting into Hinduism as well. And this is the state that I was in when I transferred as a junior to the University of California at Santa Cruz. Now, Santa Cruz was kind of an alternative to the UC system. It was situated up in the Redwoods, overlooking the Monterey Bay, and it was based on smaller clusters of colleges. The class sizes were very small, and they didn't have letter grades. Everybody just got a written evaluation at the end of each course. And Santa Cruz was also a real hotbed for any kind of crazy religious philosophy that you can imagine. And I loved it. It was right up my alley at the time. So I fell into the student life there, and not too far into the quarter, I ended up meeting and falling in love with a beautiful young woman named Sarah, who stood up a moment ago, my matushka. Now, Sarah's a key person in my life, obviously, and certainly a key person in my conversion story. She was raised Methodist and grew up as kind of a good church-going girl. But she remembers also, she was an altar server, and being instructed at the end of the service to pour down the drain the unused communion juice. And this just shocked her. Even though the Methodists had no understanding or no conception of that being the blood of Christ, it was just done in remembrance of him. Still, this seemed like an incredibly irreverent thing to do. And this really bothered her. as was the fashion at the time, by the time she was in high school, she also started to get into Far Eastern spirituality, Native American spirituality, and also was dabbling and toying a bit with the occult. So that first semester, she was working on a paper on St. Augustine, and this paper was on the nature of good and evil. And there was some big event happening on the campus at that time, and I and everybody else had cleared out of the dorm, and we were attending this event. And Sarah, being the procrastinator that she was, had one night in which to finish this paper. And so she's sitting there alone in the dorms, and sitting at her desk and trying to conjure in her mind the picture of pure evil. A very, very dangerous thing to do. She's sitting there at her desk, no one's in the dorm, and she's thinking, you know, what is evil? All of a sudden, there are three knocks on her door. And that dorm had very creaky hallways. There, nobody had approached, and out of the blue, these three knocks happened on her door. The hair on the back of her neck stood up. It was very, very creepy. And she went to the door and opened it. And her paper name tag was off the door, about 10 feet down the hallway, sitting at this weird 45-degree angle facing her. She freaked out, appropriately so, and ran back into the room, scooped up her papers, and got out of there. She wasn't quite sure where she was going, but she knew where she didn't want to be, and she ended up wandering around a little bit around the campus and remembered that there were writing tutors. These were upperclassmen that had a job of providing assistance to usually the freshmen with their papers. So Sarah went to the writing tutor. And the writing tutor on duty that evening was a young man by the name of James Carraza, a name that many of you recognize. He is now Hiram James, the rector of the old cathedral in Fulton. James was a catechumen at the time, and he was actively being catechized in the faith and was able to transmit that directly to Sarah as they talked about the nature of good and evil. And they ended up spending the whole night, you know, talking. And Sarah was finding that everything James was relaying to her about orthodoxy just seemed to make great sense. Now, James was not the only catechumen or orthodox person on the campus there. In the midst of all the crazy, crazy spiritual hedonism and goofiness that was around Santa Cruz at that time, and just to give you a flavor of it, one of the most flagrant and kooky was a group called the Breatharians. There was a guy who was the guru of this group, and he was convincing people that all the nutrients that you needed could be had by this technique of breathing and gathering the nutrients from the air. Well, there were a lot of naive people, and several of them ended up in the hospital. The funniest part, or the most tragic part, is I forget his name, but the guy who was leading this group was later discovered in a 7-Eleven buying Twinkies. So this gives you a sense of the atmosphere that was in Santa Cruz at the time. But in the midst of all that, there was this little nucleus of an Orthodox Christian fellowship. And this Orthodox Christian fellowship was really kind of spearheaded and driven by another man by the name of James, James Paffhausen. Another name you may recognize. He's now Metropolitan Jonah, the first hierarch of the OCA. And James had converted a couple of years earlier when he was in San Diego, and he was really, really gung-ho, and ended up roping a number of people into interest in the Orthodox faith. He was involved in inviting a number of people down to the campus in Santa Cruz, including Father Seraphim Rose, the recently reposed protopriest Konstantin Tibetsky, and most notably for this story, Hiram Monk Anastasi Newcomb, the former rector of the old cathedral. So there was this nucleus of this group, and I feel I have to take a second here and just recognize the great work that Father Anastasi and some of these others were able to accomplish. You know, from this little Orthodox Christian fellowship of 12 people, 9 of them are now in lifelong service to the church. That includes Metropolitan Jonah, 3 hieromonks, Hieromonk Gerasim and Damascene from Platina, Hieromonk James at the Old Cathedral, my godson, Monk Lazarus, who's at St. Sava's Monastery in the Holy Land. There's a nun, Sophia, who's at a Serbian convent in, I think, Indiana. There's a deacon, John Dibbs, who's up in Fairfield. Yeehaw. And my matushka and myself. You know, that's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. And it's certainly testament to the missionary efforts of Father Anastasi and of others. So Sarah and some of the others were certainly trying to interest me in Orthodoxy. At the time, I was still pretty far off in my Yogananda land. But James and Sarah started heading off on the weekends to go to San Francisco and up to Calistoga and other, as they told me, churches and monasteries. But who was this guy taking my girlfriend off on the weekends? I didn't know about this. Father James still loves to needle me about that to this day. So Father Anastasi would come down occasionally and give talks on the campus. And on one occasion, Sarah was able to rope me into coming up to meet him. And I'm not quite sure what I was expecting, but I was really struck by Father Anastasi. He seemed so down to earth and so genuine. He certainly had an encyclopedic knowledge of the fathers. He's incredibly eloquent and an incredibly effective missionary, especially with people of our age. I remember just being quite taken by him. And in addition to all these wonderful aspects, he also had a fairly lively sense of humor. I remember on one occasion, he was visiting James Carrazza in his dorm, and the dormitories at Santa Cruz at that time, I'm not sure whose brainchild this was, but they were co-ed, including the restrooms. And I remember some of the students, the rooms around the outer corridors of this, you know, kind of rectangular hallways, and the interior was where the restrooms and washrooms and things were. And some of the students had put, you know, men on one of the doors and women on the other. And you can imagine some of the parents' surprise as they each went to the restroom and met each other in the middle. So Father Anastasi was in the restroom and washing his hands. And he's there at the wash basin, and in walks this young blonde woman. And Father bolted upright thinking, what have I done? Am I in the woman's restroom? And the woman saw his alarm and reassured him and explained to him that, you know, don't worry, Father, these are co-ed rooms, that, you know, you're in the right place. And Father's response was classic. He sat there for a moment, you know, continuing to dry his hands, and he said, well, if they'd had co-ed dorms when I was a young man, I may never have become a monk. He was an incredibly effective missionary, and toward the end of Sarah's sophomore year, she ended up being baptized up at the Skeet in Point Reyes, the St. Eugene's Hermitage. And by this time, I was supportive. However, I still considered myself somehow above all this. I considered Orthodoxy, you know, just one flower in the bouquet of God, as I put it. But I was happy for her. And that summer, Sarah took off, and she went to Switzerland, where she lived that summer and worked in a market there. I had finished my classwork and went through the graduation ceremonies, and I still had a senior thesis to write, but I decided to take a couple of months off, and I was going to borrow my brother's pickup truck and just kind of roam the western states for a month or two. So I equipped myself with the various camping equipment and food and a stack of books. And Sarah managed to insert a couple of books in that stack. One of them was entitled The Monk of Banathos by Father Sophroni about Elder Sivan. And the other was a book called The Way of a Pilgrim. I'm sure many of you are familiar with The Way of a Pilgrim. It's a story of a Russian pilgrim who hears the apostles' injunction to pray unceasingly. And he wanders around Holy Russia to the various monasteries and fathers and learns the Jesus prayer. As I began my journey, I started to read that book, and I was fantasizing myself to be a pilgrim of some sort. And I began saying the Jesus prayer on and off as I was beginning to wander around. One of the stops that I made was in Denver. And Denver was where my old friend Jeff, the Buddhist, was living at that time. And I had a nice visit with Jeff for a couple of days. And on the last night that we were together, we got into a prolonged discussion about spirituality. And I think I surprised myself in saying that I was beginning to think that orthodoxy might be it. And Jeff's reaction to that was a real eye-opener for me. He really bristled at that statement, and he said, "Don't you ever stop searching." And that really hit me. I responded with some amount of passion myself that I'm not in this searching for searching's sake. I'm looking for that ladder. And when I find it, I want to climb. I don't want to keep searching. And Jeff and I kind of parted ways philosophically that day. But it was a bit of a turning point for me in starting to realize that something was crystallizing. So I headed south and went into New Mexico. And very, very shortly after I'd closed the book and finished The Way of the Pilgrim, I was traveling through the New Mexican desert. And walking alongside the road, there was this guy, all in denim with a bedroll. And I pulled over and I offered him a ride. He hopped in. His name was Jim. And he ended up riding with me for two or three days. It was an amazing providential encounter. I still had the autobiography of a yogi sitting on the dashboard. And Jim saw that and started to talk about Hinduism and Eastern spirituality. It turned out that he had been involved in that society, the Self-Realization Fellowship, in the 1950s. And he, over time, kind of won me over in terms of clearly knowing what he was talking about as he spoke about Hinduism, about Eastern spirituality and such. But then he started to pick it all apart. He started to show me that true Christianity and true Hinduism were miles apart, that most of the Far Eastern spirituality that had been presented to the West had really been sort of packaged up and watered down in order to appeal to the Western mind. The concepts of reincarnation, of polytheism, karma, and the ultimate goal of the dissolution of the self into God are very, very much opposed to the Christian understanding that we have one life to live, not many. That there is one God, not many. That God is merciful and loving, not bound by some karmic justice. And that the goal of our life is not the dissolving of ourself into God, but the healing and the salvation of our person and our eternal relationship with the person of God. It was a really incredible couple of days with this guy, and I'll never forget his parting shot to me. He, I was dropping him off, and he was standing at the passenger door with the door open, and he said, "Listen, in every religion, there is some aspect of truth, and that's what attracts us to it. But until you find Jesus Christ, who is the truth himself, you will never find peace." And he shut the door. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, it hit me like a ton of bricks. And so from that, I pretty much resolved I was going to point the truck to Northern California, and I was going to go visit Father Anastasi. I did head up there, and I was going to say unfortunately, but it's probably providentially, it's probably the better word. Father Anastasi was quite busy. There were a number of pilgrims there at the time. And Father Anastasi equipped me with a cassette tape of his reading of St. Innocent's Way into the Kingdom of Heaven, and gave me directions to go to Platina to visit Father Seraphim Rose. So that's what I did. I was playing this tape and listening to the words of St. Innocent, and it really kind of prepared me for the experience that I had up at the St. Herman Monastery. I arrived there, and my old school chum, Father Gerasim, greeted me, and ended up spending about a week there, during which time I was really blessed to have a number of long talks and walks with Father Seraphim. He really, really struck me as a man who was genuinely living his Orthodox faith. He, as many of you may know, had been involved in Far Eastern spirituality as a young man, and he was able to even more, in a more focused way, disabuse me of some of my Hindu leanings, which I was already kind of drifting away from at the time. But one of the things that really struck me about Father Seraphim was he really had kind of a laser beam focus. He kept saying, you know, what's the point? You know, what are they getting at? You know, just really trying to drive at what's the bottom line of the various things that we were talking about. At the end of that week, I ended up being made a catechumen by Father Seraphim in the little wooden church that was there at the time. And they loaded me up with some books and sent me on my way. They gave me the two that really profoundly struck me were the Northern Thebaid, which was a collection of the lives of Russian saints in the northern forests of Russia, and then also the Jordanville prayer book. I started reading the morning and evening prayers, and I was also really, really touched by the Canon of Repentance. At the end of that incredible summer, I received a call from Father Gerasim that Father Seraphim was in the hospital and that things did not look very good. So I got in my car and I drove up to Reading, and I spent that next week with a number of people that were at Father Seraphim's bedside and holding vigil in one of the hospital waiting rooms. It was an amazing time of incredible prayerful unity with other people. And this one occasion really struck me and confirmed Orthodoxy for me. There were about half a dozen of us gathered around Father Seraphim's bedside, and it was either Father Alexei or Father Herman had come in to do a molyeben for Father Seraphim. And at the end of the molyeben, they took the gospel and they blessed him with it. Now, Father Seraphim was hooked up with, you know, IVs and monitors, tubes down his mouth, and convulsing in pain. It was really, he had quite a death. But when they blessed him with that gospel, he sat up to try to kiss that book that had given him life. And there was not a dry eye in that room, that's for sure. And this for me really, really confirmed Orthodoxy for me. I'd only seen Father Seraphim twice. The first time I saw him, I feel like I saw how an Orthodox man might live. And the second time that I saw him, I saw how an Orthodox man might die. And both were really profound experiences for me. The other thing that kind of sealed my decision toward baptism is also something that I find just amazing. I was back in Santa Cruz, and I came up here to the cathedral, to the liturgy, and I was standing in the back of the church, enjoying the service, and looking around at all the beautiful icons and things, and my eyes stopped on this one icon that I later found out was entitled Not Made by Hands. That was the image that I saw that January afternoon. There it was. And I couldn't believe it. I really felt like I'd come full circle, and Orthodoxy was where I belonged, and where God had been directing me, that compass point had hit the true north, so to speak. Now, meanwhile, back at the ranch, Sarah had been praying fervently that somehow I would be converted. All of our schoolmates had taken the monastic path, and that was just sort of the default, in a sense, for us. And Sarah was also quite attracted to monasticism. But she felt she couldn't leave me out in the world, that the best possible scenario would be if I would convert and want to become a monk, then she'd be free to go and become a nun. So as she's over there in Switzerland, I start writing her letters, talking about, oh, I'm really enjoying Way of a Pilgrim. Oh, I met this amazing guy in New Mexico. Oh, I'm with Father Seraphim in Platina. I'm a catechumen, By the time she came home, I think I had incense burning in my ashtray or some crazy thing. And I was pretty gung-ho. I was myself thinking, oh yes, I'm gonna become a monk. Looking back on it, I think that Sarah and I were the only two among all of our friends that had any sense that we would be anything other than married together. And I remember talking to one of the fathers up in Platina, and he gave me this good advice. He said, it's better for a married man to have monastic inclinations than for a monastic to have marital inclinations. Good advice, good advice. But glory to God, through the blessings of our spiritual fathers and certainly with the support of our family and of all our friends, we were married. Prior to that, I was baptized, of course. And we've been able to live a wonderful life together of mutual service one to another. And raised three great kids. I have two daughters and a son that we neglected to mention at the beginning. I could certainly go on and tell you about the tremendous love and support that we've received by the Russian community, the fantastic parish priests that I've had the benefit of being under. All the adventures and continued intercessions that God has provided that led me to the priesthood. Being an American convert in the Russian church wasn't always a simple thing, especially in those early days of the early 80s. There wasn't that much literature in English, and it certainly led to some funny misunderstandings. A couple I'll share with you. I was up here in San Francisco, and I was attending church, and this old Russian babushka came up and said, why are you in the Russian church? And I told her, I'm Orthodox. I'm here in the Orthodox church. And she thought about that for a second, and she said, but you don't speak Russian. And I said, no, unfortunately, I don't. She thought that over for a second, and she said, when you die, how are you going to talk to God? It's classic. Another funny language issue was Sarah was singing in the choir in Palo Alto, and it was the choir's feast day. And one of the lovely older women there came to Sarah and grabbed her by the arm and was very concerned that Sarah come down and sit with the choir. And she said, Sarah, you know, come downstairs. You'll see a table there. It has a sign, X-O-P. That means whore. You sit there. So, you know, the fact is that we're all strangers in a strange land here. We're all pilgrims in a sense in our earthly existence. And whether we're born into the faith or whether we come to it later in life, we're all converts. And we need to be. We need to be actively engaged in that process of converting. Converting from the thing that we were to the thing that we might become. I remember hearing Metropolitan Callistos Ware give a lecture one time, and he told us he was riding in a train, and this woman saw him in his you know, priestly attire, and she said to him, you know, oh, are you saved? That's just a weird question to ask an Orthodox Christian. But he came up with an excellent response. He responded to her, my dear, I am being saved. This is a great, great response and a spiritual truth that we're always in this process of being saved. So that's the basic summary of the events of my conversion to the Orthodox faith. And as I emphasized at the beginning, and as I hope has come through in this presentation, it's really the story of Jesus Christ and of his incredible patience and sometimes miraculous intercessions in order to knock some sense into one of his more thick-headed sheep. The fact is, though, that God is always going to extraordinary lengths to reach each and every one of us. And we just need to have our eyes open to see the amazing confluence of things that God arranges in our life to draw us toward him. You know, some of these things may be wonderful, and some of these things may be incredibly tragic. You know, they may involve the terminal illness of somebody close to us. You know, we may be dealing with the loss of jobs, all these various things that can come about. But we have to have our eyes set higher. We have to have our eyes set on the reality that whatever happens in this life, it's all prelude. It's all preparation for the healing of our soul so that we can come before the throne of God. And God will do whatever is right and whatever is necessary in order to heal us, in order to facilitate our salvation. I really, really believe this is true. We just have to have that tremendous, tremendous trust in him, to love him and to know that he's watching out for us. And we have to be grateful. We have to be grateful for whatever comes our way. You know, in coming into the ark of the Orthodox Church, I feel that God has taken me by the hand and brought me the long way back home. In the teachings and in the healing sacraments of Christ's Church, I found that compass point, that northern star that can safely guide us on our journey homeward. Thank you for your patience in listening to me. I know that I'm not worthy to stand in front of you and to tell you anything about Orthodoxy. I remember Father Anastasi saying to us when we were students, he said, boys, you've been given much. Be generous with your lives. God has certainly been generous to me, and that inspires and encourages me. And I hope that in giving this little talk, I've been able to convey some of that treasure to you, and may God be glorified. Thank you. Next, Father.
Next is, we put you against the wall.
Thank you very much, Father. Thank you very much. And we have about half an hour for questions. And they could be about Father. You could ask whatever questions you like, either about Father Martin's personal path, or maybe you just have questions you'd like to ask a priest. They don't necessarily have to be about about conversion or about Father Martin's path. Just any questions you'd like to ask, you're free to do so. And perhaps questions of a pastoral nature. Father has been, serving in Los Angeles. So please go ahead. I'll get a microphone.
Yes, Mother. Yeah. The question was if I could elaborate a little bit on the path that led me to the priesthood. I was made a reader when we were still at the parish in Palo Alto, the Protection of the Mother of God parish there, under Father Vladimir Derugin. Father Vladimir was one of those wonderful priests for me. If I'm going to mention him, I'm going to really quickly run through a couple of others. My first parish priest was actually Vladika Kirill at his on 6th Avenue, back when he was Hiramon Kirill. And I'm going to really generalize here, but from Vladika, I think I learned the dignity of Orthodoxy. From Father Vladimir Derugin in Palo Alto, he is a tremendous liturgist, and I learned a lot serving the altar with him about liturgical practice. He actually kind of put several of us through the paces, preparing us for the diaconate even back then. And I also learned a lot about discipline from Father Vladimir. He was a bit of a drill sergeant priest. From there, we went up to Santa Rosa to Father Alexander Krasovsky, and the characteristic I would attribute to Father Alexander is compassionate love. And then moving down to Los Angeles, the priest who was there at the time was Father Peter Shashkov. And Father Peter, in addition to being a wonderfully humorous man, facilitated my coming into the priesthood finally. So my road to the priesthood was a pretty long one. I was made a reader by Vladika Anthony back in Palo Alto, I think in 1988 or something, and was a reader for many, many years, a mitered arch reader, as they say. Father Vladimir was initially pushing me to become a deacon, but I knew I wasn't ready. I knew I was too immature, and it just wasn't the right time. And I begged God to let this cup pass from me at that time, and ended up being laid off from my job, and ended up finding work up in Sonoma County. So I was with Father Alexander for a while, and Father Alexander also was, putting the idea of perhaps my accepting the diaconate. I still was scared. And then when we came down to Los Angeles, there was this early morning English liturgy, and they needed a deacon there, and Father Peter ended up roping me into it. And it was great. I served as a deacon for 3 years in the early English liturgy. And I think it was 2005, my son and I made a pilgrimage to the Holy Land. And we went to visit my godson, Father Lazarus, at St. Sava's. We spent a week there. And then we went and spent some time. Our home base was the convent on the Mount of Olives, and we went into the holy sites around Jerusalem. And I had not as visual, but I had another profound experience when I was at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. I went upstairs there to the site of Golgotha, where Christ was crucified. And I remember just being like a wave hitting me. This realization that you know, you did this for me. How dare I say no to anything that you want me to do? And so I came home, and Father Peter, in his mischievous way, said, "Any changes of heart, Martin?" And I told him, "If I'm asked, I'm no longer going to say no." Well, he was a man of action. He called Vladika, and Vladika had known me, you know, for many, many years, and was favorable toward it. And I have a full-time secular job. I work in software, and I was over in Munich, Germany, at this meeting, sitting there, this table with, you know, a bunch of programmers sitting around with our laptops open. And all of a sudden, ping, in comes this incoming email from Father Peter Shashkov entitled, "Life as you know it is over." And I double-clicked it and I opened it up, and it said I was to report that weekend here to the Sobor, and that I was going to be ordained that Sunday. I'm sure all the color, what little there is of it, drained from my face. And I flew home from Munich that Friday, turned around and got on the plane back up to San Francisco the next day, and was ordained here. So, and, you know, having been ordained, it seemed like the right thing. It seemed like, you know, what had I been waiting for, in a sense? Because God's grace certainly is bestowed upon, you know, that ordination, and it's ended up being a wonderful thing.
What are your feelings on missionary work? It seems in Santa Cruz there was a concentrated effort. Do you feel that such concentrated effort should it have an organized structure and form? Let's say here in California, is there an organized structure and form? Should it just be pursued on a parish level? What are your feelings? Is it not being done? It seems there are people who, you know, want things done on a parochial level, some on a diocesan level. What are your feelings on a missionary outreach? Mm-hmm. What is the potential and what is needed for that?
My immediate reaction is somehow I think it has to come from the heart. You know, this, what we encountered there in Santa Cruz came from the heart of James and of Father Anastasi, and those people that just had this burning desire in their heart to share Orthodoxy. Somehow it seems that organizations and committees may not be as effective. I may be wrong, but I think that not enough is being done. I think that we do need to take upon ourselves more of that sense and that responsibility. You know, Christ called us to go out and you know, to be fishers of men. And I think there's a lot less today as opposed to, you know, 30 years ago, of kind of the insular sense of, you know, why are you at the Russian church? But still, I think that we can tend to look too inward into our own parish. I remember there was a little mission parish in Reading, at the home of the Harveys, and I think Father Alexei Young had put this sign up at the back of the church. As you were leaving, it said, "You are now entering the mission territory." You know, and that's a good mentality to have. I remember in my earlier years being incredibly self-conscious to cross myself at work or in restaurants or in public places. I'm not sure what my problem was, but as I would get over that and get past myself and glory God, Lord, you know, glorify God by crossing myself before I eating. Suddenly people, you know, come out of the woodwork and you find people who are in their own private lives appreciating God and having some sense of the love of God kind of come out of the woodwork. It's like this hidden secret that we're all afraid to share with each other. And I think we need to be bolder and we need to not, you know, start going door to door like the Jehovah's Witnesses, but we need to not be afraid to be orthodox, to be different, to, when asked, share our faith.
And my question is, how do we reconcile conceptually or by prayer the differences between what you have experienced in the oriental teaching with catechism and the teachings of St. Gregory Palamas, the release of consciousness into the uncreated light?
Mm-hmm. I think the biggest difference, and it is a very pronounced one, is that in Orthodoxy, we're always dealing with the person of God. We're not dealing with a concept. We're not dealing with this kind of infinite absolute. We're not dissolving, you know, into nirvana. Our personhood is always distinct. And the personhood of God is always distinct. And it's that relationship between persons. And this is really the whole concept of love. You know, if you think about the concept and the reality of God being a Trinity, this is incredibly profound. You know, I remember hearing as a child, you know, their bumper stickers, God is love. What does that mean? What does that mean? But as you look at Orthodox theology and St. Gregory Palamas and others, the fact that our God is this unity of Trinity means that there's this selfless love that's going on in the person of God. The Father is selflessly loving the Son and the Holy Spirit. The Son is selflessly loving the Father and the Holy Spirit. And the Holy Spirit is selflessly loving the Father and the Son. There's this energy of love going on in the very personhood of God. And this is a very, very profound concept. And it's in the transformation of ourselves and in our focus on that same kind of selfless love that we begin to participate in that energy of God. This is a very, very different and distinct thing than what I was encountering in the Eastern Oriental religions.
Well, as a follow-on to my question, how do you reconcile it with the ascetic teachings of the Russian saints,
like Hesychism,
in particular?
Well, my experience of Eastern meditation was one of you know, quieting, of banishing thoughts, and there's a lot of similarity there. But again, the point of it was not to reach this state of this kind of bliss where all thought was quieted and you know, you just reach this kind of self-satisfying level of tranquility. In Hesychism, we are encountering the person of Christ, and that hesychastic practice of the Jesus prayer is one of encounter. It's not one of disillusion.
Hi, Father.
Hi. There you are.
I was, before the gentleman asked those questions, I'm a student of comparative religion, and I've done a little reading on Paramahansa Yogananda. I found his commentary on the Gospels kind of laughable, but his own life, he's a very intriguing character.
He is,
And I can't but help look at his life and the life of some of our elders and see a lot of positive ways that in which they're similar. No, I'm not going to. I never endorse a kind of faceless God, or in his case, he would refer to God as my father, and mm-hmm. Trying to develop a Christ consciousness
right.
by means of Kriya Yoga meditation.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly among people that I know that are still involved with SRF and Wayne Fine, they tell stories about him which are miraculous. Now, we as Orthodox Christians, we see the miraculous in our saints, and we know that that's real. But what about a character like him who had, an inkling, certainly, of the truth? There was truth there. Maybe the greater part was not true.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that he was, at least honestly trying to pursue his the best he could.
Mm-hmm.
Those miraculous things that happened in his life, do we as Orthodox have to say that they were necessarily of the devil or, some sort of negative influence? Could they have been God working through him?
I think we as Orthodox need to be careful. We need to be very, very careful and cautious because, as that my pilgrim friend Jim had said to me, and as Father Seraphim also said to me, and Yogananda is a great example because so much of his life and his writings was really packaged up for the Western mind. You read the autobiography of a yogi and it's like reading the lives of saints. There's these levitating saints and all this wild stuff. I think that some of these people certainly achieved a level of spirituality. And I think that mankind can reach up toward God. But think of the Michelangelo's Sistine Chapel, with Adam reaching up toward God. He can't reach. The other aspect of what's happening there is God is reaching down in order for them to touch. And I think that some of the aspects of Buddhism, some of the aspects of Hinduism, some of the aspects of some of the Native American spirituality, I can't stand here and say they don't have some merit. That there's that aspect of truth that we respond to. But we know, I know that Orthodoxy is not just the most profound expression of mankind's relationship to God. It's something markedly different. It's revelation of God to mankind. It's that intersection point where God is reaching down and man is reaching up. And this is, it can be very attractive and very persuasive to be inspired by some of the heights that some of these guys attained. And, that's good. But God has revealed himself to us. And he has revealed himself to us in the person of Jesus Christ. And Christ established the church, through the apostles. And, we know this is the historic receptacle of the fullness of the grace of God. And why settle for anything less,
Yes, I was curious to know what your family's reaction was to, for both you and Sarah, what your family's reaction was to your conversion initially, and has it become a journey?
Yeah, it's we really went through some times. Sarah's mother is a religious woman, a very strong Methodist and a very committed Protestant Christian. And she was very resistant. Sarah really went through some blood, sweat, and tears with her mom over, you know, converting to Orthodoxy. Her mother, I don't know where the idea came from, but her mother was convinced that those Orthodox worship eggs. She was very, very concerned about what Sarah was getting herself into. And I remember another funny story. After I graduated from Santa Cruz, I went to San Francisco State and I got my teaching credential. And I was living at home with my father that year. And this is after I had converted. And it was a Wednesday or a Friday or some fast period. But my father came down and I'm sitting there at breakfast having a bowl of grape nuts and applesauce. My father looks at this and says, "You know what? You know, are we out of milk? You know, what's this?" And so I, in my young convert zeal, you know, gave him like a 2-minute lecture about fasting and Orthodoxy. And he looked at me, you know, out of the top of his glasses, and his response is great. Think about this in the context and the meaning of fasting. He said, "Whatever turns you on." But our families were, my family was kind of dismissive. My father and my brother had kind of gotten used to me going through all kinds of crazy, you know, I was a gung-ho, you know, Jesus t-shirt guy. So they thought on, you know, another phase. Sarah's mother was very concerned, and, you know, concerned enough that, you know, she came to Sarah's baptism. She started attending some services. And she grew to respect it. And actually, Father Anastasi had a big part in that. She thought very highly of Father. Sarah's mother to this day is supportive, I would say. And I'm sure she would love for us to come to the Methodist camps and things. But she understands. And she's actually quite proud of my priesthood and supportive. Any other questions? Yes, Bogdan.
You mentioned at 12 years old you saw an image of Christ.
Yeah.
Either they saw an icon later on in your life?
Yes.
That matched that image.
Yes, very, very evocative of that image. Yeah, it's the icon that's not made by hands, the holy napkin, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, this icon, when I saw it, it's on the, I think it's over the left altar in the cathedral here.
So was that close of the image that you remember?
Oh yeah, it was, I mean, I can't say, you know, it was precisely that, but it, when I saw that, it really, really struck me. That was basically the image that I saw, yeah. Yeah, yeah, it was a wow.
Father, could you repeat the questions when you...
I'm sorry, yes, yes, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. He was asking about the, you know, that image that I saw that January afternoon and the icon. Yeah.
I was wondering about the comment that you made about, you know, the Russian Baba asking you why you were in the Russian church.
Yes.
How was it to be a convert back in those days? I mean, I've read Father Seraphim's biography, and it seems, I mean, well, he was a genius, and of course he could learn Russian.
Yeah.
But what was it like at that time? Because, you know, I came into a church that has that just perfect mission between convert and cradle. You know, the converts get everyone excited, and the cradles to sort of level out the crazy. So... So this is sort of the second part of my question. So what was it like then?
Mm-hmm.
And let's say that you were in an area where most of the churches are very Greek or very Arabic or very Russian.
Yeah.
And you want to share Orthodoxy with other people. Is there a way that can still reach out to people regardless of its foreignness and seeming inaccessibility?
Yeah. It certainly was more, I would say, more foreign back then, and there were certainly a lot less accommodations made toward English and converts at that time. But this is just personally, I ended up growing to really, and still feel this way somewhat, to really have a love and appreciation of the Church Slavonic. Father Vladimir's Matushka ended up teaching me how to read Slavonic, and I'll serve in Slavonic sometimes in at our church. But because my only exposure to Russian and to Slavonic was in the church context, it almost became kind of this language of prayer for me. And so, you know, the vigil is a little different, but certainly the liturgy is there's enough common elements that occur week to week that, you know, we would be able to stand with our English translation and get used to the flow and understand, oh, this is, okay, here comes the cherubic hymn, okay, here comes Our Father, you know. You get a good sense of the basic flow of the service, and it's really not dependent upon knowing the language, especially if you're able to follow along with the translation. I think that for many people, one of the things that strikes them about Orthodoxy is the richness of the service. You know, it's really a full sensory sense of worship. You know, your eyes, your ears, your nose, you know, everything is being stimulated spiritually in that sense. And it doesn't matter what language it is in that sense. One of the things that I've found wonderful about Orthodoxy is this sense of timelessness and spacelessness. You know, I've been able to travel, you know, to a number of different places, and you walk into an Orthodox church, and you know, there's the iconostasis with Christ on the right and the Mother of God on the left, and the basic, you know, form of the liturgy is the same. It can be in Arabic, it can be in Greek, it can be in Klingit, you know. You know where you are, you're home, and that's, I think, one of the wonderful parts of Orthodoxy.
I understand the language of prayer. I definitely have an appreciation for Slavonic, the liturgical Greek and Arabic. It's just more of a, you know, if you were driven enough,
yeah,
then you would be able to overlook that.
Uh-huh.
Talking about more along the lines of someone with an intellectual curiosity that might be sort of propelled by some of the more ethnic
right. Yeah.
How can you sort of show Orthodoxy to that kind of person who would, you know, not maybe go out of their way to learn Russian, or is not yet fully driven in the direction?
So how can we show Orthodoxy to someone who's not really motivated to put themselves, you know, into the effort of, you know, learning or even appreciating some of these other languages? I think that's a challenge. I thank God that there is so much available in English now. You know, we have such a rich availability of spiritual literature in English, and I think there's plenty to point people to in that regard. In terms of, you know, the worship itself, if you're in an area where there isn't an English language service available, you know, that could be an obstacle. I'm not quite sure off the top of my head what profound advice I can offer to you, but I think that it needs to be a combination of, you know, doing your own homework and pursuit, and the availability of texts is certainly there. And if the particular worship service itself is only occurring in a foreign language, I think that's just something that needs to be patiently dealt with. Some of the ethnicism that occurs is unfortunate. I mean, that's just the reality sometimes of what needs to be dealt with. But one of the things that that I think is really, really important is I remember going to confession with Father Vladimir in Palo Alto, and my first couple of years in Orthodoxy, I was on cloud nine. I mean, I was flying. It was the honeymoon, you know. And then that started to wane. That initial, you know, lift off started to go. And I remember coming to Father Vladimir to confession and you know, confessing to him that I was really starting to struggle with prayer, that, you know, my soul just felt dry, you know, you know, everything is difficult. And I expected him to, you know, wrap me over the back of the head or something. And he surprised me. He said, "Well, Martin, welcome to Orthodoxy." You know? And it's true. We have to have this, we have to have patience. You know, our whole society is such an, you know, instant gratification society, and all of our Orthodox journeys are, you know, it's a lifelong process, and we're going to go through, you know, hot spells and dry spells, and we need to just buckle up and be patient, you know, and continue on.
Thank you, Father, for your testimony and your graciousness in sharing it. I wanted to ask you, when you hit your head on the window, and you said there were a couple of hours that passed that you were kind of unaware of.
I didn't hit my head.
Oh, you didn't?
No. I know where you're going. No.
I just wanted to get a little bit more insight on what the couple of hours was like for you in your encounter. Why you said it? Why you described it the way you did? What was your experience a little bit more detailed like?
Well, the thing that really amazed me about it was literally that 2 hours was like a minute. It was I was completely shocked that suddenly my friend was there. I thought he, you know, what are you doing here? And I realized that 2 hours had gone by. So that. That was very odd, and as I said, you know, to this day I don't have any recollection of precisely what was going on. I mean, I know I was on my knees, and I know I was left with this taste, this atmosphere. I'm not quite sure what word to put on it. But this sense that I described, that sense of holiness, of you know, really kind of being at the feet of God, and also that lingering sense of warmth, of love. I don't think I'll ever be able to really articulate it.
Thanks.
Okay, all right, we'll see. It's a bit more of a read, but certainly a fantastic introduction to the history of the church as Metropolitan Felicitas, or Timothy, wears the Orthodox Church. That does a really, really good job of giving you kind of the overview of the history of the church. One of my absolute favorite books, and this is something that I recommend to Orthodox, and as I'm speaking here, I'm thinking, would this be a good one for... It might be a good one for somebody who's not Orthodox yet, but who wants to get an appreciation of Orthodox spirituality. Bishop Theophon the Recluse's book, The Spiritual Life and How to Be Attuned to It, is fantastic. It's a collection of his writings to a young woman, and he goes step by step, and you find yourself about halfway through the book at these profound things that he's saying, and without any sense of the difficulty of getting to where he's led you. You know, it's a beautiful, beautiful book. And in terms of websites, at the parish where I serve, one of the priests who was there, who's later a bishop, Bishop Alexander Milliant, he put quite an extensive website together. It's fatheralexander.org. And there's a lot of information there. He talks about a lot of contemporary issues, comparisons of Orthodoxy to other religions. Has a lot of commentary there on the Orthodox services, etc. It's very good. You know, I didn't go to any of Father Seraphim's lectures when he was down there. I was off in my little Hindu land. yes, that book, God's Revelation to the Human Heart, was a lecture that Father Seraphim gave to the students there. And he was also invited to speak at I'll call him Metropolitan Jonas, World Religions class. I think he spoke there about the apocalypse and end times. I don't know if that's been put into text at all at this point. I look back with a little bit of regret having missed a few things, because I came into it a little bit toward the end there. As I said, I really only met him twice.
I have two questions, and the second I'll probably ask Father Nicholas as well. The first question is, in a nutshell, how would you answer one of the most common reactions of people when you begin talking about Orthodox and other religions? They all say, well, God is the same, does really matter? And what would your response be to that comment, in a nutshell? And the second thing is, I was Moscow recently, and we were having a dinner, and there was a girl there. She kept asking a lot of questions, and one of the questions she asked, I was kind of hard pressed to answer, and she said, well, how, for example, if I'm saved and my husband is not, how can I remain in the presence of God, knowing that my husband is like burning in hell, or is not with God, and the pain that brings, that people who are not Orthodox or are not in church or are atheists, how can I just worry about my salvation? And if I do attain it, how can I be in eternal blessedness, knowing that all my family members are not in the same place or not in the same state?
Right.
And she said, even my pets.
Anyone but Fido. So the first part of that question was asking about the different conceptions of God, and does it really matter? Aren't they all the same? I would argue no, they're not the same. I think I spoke to that a little bit in defining a few of the things that differentiate Hinduism and Christianity, about, you know, the reincarnation, karma, these other things. But even within these expressions of Christianity, you know, Protestantism and Catholicism and Orthodoxy, I think there are marked differences and important differences that can impact the healing and the health of our soul. There's actually a really, really good book that I just read called Orthodoxy and Heterodoxy. I forget the name of the author, but... Okay. I couldn't hear it, but... Yeah, anyway, it's a very, very nice book. And what I really liked about this book is that he was very fair in his assessments and summaries of the teachings of, he went through a number of them, but he spent quite a bit of time on some of the Protestant sects and also Roman Catholicism. And he differentiated some of the teachings of these things. And also ended each chapter with sort of a hopeful summary of how might one approach somebody from one of these different faith traditions. Where is the common ground where you can begin a conversation and then perhaps lead them closer toward orthodoxy. But I think, again, to kind of perhaps generalize, I always thought of Roman Catholicism as being very, very legalistic. The experiences that I'd had, I was never part of that church, but the reading that I've done and the people that I've talked to there, it always struck me as being very formulaic. You know, you do this sin, you do this penance, this is very, very much opposed to the Orthodox approach. The Orthodox approach I would characterize as very much being a sense of healing. I've heard somebody describe confession in this way, and it's probably a good distinction between my idea of Roman Catholicism and Orthodoxy. That people come to confession like they're coming into the courtroom to stand before the judge. And they state their sins, and the judge listens to it and looks at the rule book and executes the sentence. As opposed to the Orthodox conception of coming to confession is like coming into the hospital, to the nurse, to the doctor, in order to heal the wounds of the soul. So I think this is one of the real discrepancies, at least in my experience of Roman Catholicism. It's very, very kind of legalistic and formulaic in my mind. And to my surprise, the more I started to look into Protestantism, well, on the one hand, there was this completely kind of emotional sense of spirituality, which, as I said, just couldn't stand up to the realities of suffering and of death that I was trying to make some sense of. There's also, in Protestantism, a tremendous sense of legalism as well. I remember Reader Dennis showing me some books of these huge volumes of concordances and cross-references and checks, and somebody once described the Protestants as having a paper pope, you know? And I think that's fairly accurate. I think that the biggest difference in my mind is this focus on the healing of the soul. And that's certainly how I would describe Orthodoxy and how I would differentiate Orthodoxy from many of these other Christian expression. And the second part about how can I enjoy heaven when Fido is burning in hell. It's a good question, and you asked Father Nikolai perhaps to join in. I may ring him in on this one. I think that it's important for us to recognize that we are only able to really affect and change and judge one person, and that one person is ourself. And that is hard enough work as it is. We don't have any time to bother, you know, looking out at others and judging others. We tend to make excuses for ourselves and hold everybody else, you know, up to these incredible expectations. And that needs to be completely flipped. We need to be making excuses for others and holding ourselves to very, very high expectations. When we come before God at the throne of God, some of the saints have said that this is like coming before fire. And depending upon the state of our soul and the grace of God that we have encountered and the state that God has granted us to experience here in this life, our soul is either going to be aflame as well. And this experience of our soul aflame coming before the fire of the throne of God will be heaven. If in this life we have rejected God and have been, centered ourselves around our own selfishness, our soul is basically dead wood. And we come before the throne of God, we come to the same place, and we're living in this in the presence of God. But that presence of God is either going to be for us that warmth and wonderful fulfillment of that encounter with the person of God, or it's going to be hell. It's going to be hell. So, Father Nikolai, did you want to chime in? Okay. Father Nikolai will elaborate in his afternoon's talk.
Thank you very much, Father. One more question. We have time.
It may be a short one. Was the study of church history at all important to you in your conversion, or was it mostly a spiritual thing?
I would say that wasn't so important to me. It became important to me later on, after I came into the church, to learn more about it, and it only served to reinforce the wonder of Orthodoxy for me. But as you've heard this afternoon, it definitely wasn't an academic pursuit for me. It was very much kind of a spiritual journey.
Thank you very much, Father Martin. Thank you.